was that ant that stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh,
one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss, they're puny.
Hmm, puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Didn't that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
seven, six, five, four, three, two, one, zero. Pass up!
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, sorry about that momentary delay there. I was kind of asleep at the wheel because I'm pasting in a link into the Super Chat room for connections to a charge controller from solar panels. So anyway, you're listening to Mad Science Show at www.shazizradio.com. you'd like to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html, where you have access to not one, but four separate chat rooms, as well as if you scroll down on the Super Chat chat room, you will find a link to People for People Radio Network. Click on that one and go over there and join in with those folks as well. Wonderful folks over there. Anyway, the secrets are in the details. Mad Science Show is live. So anyway, I don't want this to turn into a snore fest, but I tried to pick out the information that was as simple as physically possible. But in order for people to be able to get what it is that to say the one clean, renewable, alternative, efficient or super efficient energy, then first you need to understand what it is that they know. And when I say they, I mean the power companies out there. You need to understand how the system even functions before you can move forward. But the secrets are in the details. So if you pay really close attention to what I'm trying to share with you, then you'll have a good understanding of how that actual system works. And with that, with a few minor modifications to how you actually generate electricity, say from solar panels or wind or even alternative energy devices, it doesn't matter, then you'll start to see the big picture. It will all come into perspective of what I've been trying to tell everybody all along. So, you know, if you bear with me through this entire deal, you know, get your coffee ready or maybe do some jumping jacks or some push-ups or something in the middle of all this so that you don't get bored and tired. I'm going to try to make it as interesting as possible, but this information, if you pay really close attention to it, everything you've been hearing me talk about for a long time about high voltage and even plasma technology for that matter will start to fall into place. It'll all start to make sense, and then, you know, maybe you'll have that eureka moment and you'll understand why it is that I say that if you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough for it. See, those transformers out there that actually distribute our power to where we need it at the proper voltages so that we can use it, they don't care where the magnetic field comes from. They don't care, what input source that you're using to push that energy into that to produce that magnetic field. Transformers generally have a primary and a secondary for simplicity's sake. Just a single step-down transformer will have more windings on the primary coil. That's where you're putting your power in. And then it'll have either less windings for lower voltages or it'll have more windings for higher voltages. So you can step it down or you can step it up depending on whatever your needs are. You can actually calculate out how many numbers of turns, lengths of wire, and stuff that you would need to build a custom transformer. When I'm done with today's show, I hope that I inspire you to try to build a custom transformer. Because if you get a general understanding of how that power is actually coming to you to begin with, then you'll see that it's not rocket science. It really isn't. It's ridiculously simple. Now, the power companies, they push a lot of power down those power lines. Obviously, that's too much power for you. Anywhere from 7,000 volts and up coming down them power lines. But see, the key about this whole thing is you're not going to be using that much power. You can't use that much power. They shoot that much power down those lines because they're providing for multiple households and businesses and buildings and so on. And so they have to send it down there like that. But like I said, the secrets are in the details. If you realize what it is I'm saying, and you go back and look at some of my experiments, like what I was talking about with the signal generator that's pulsing a 60 hertz square wave at approximately a 9 volt output, and it's using a microwave oven transformer to ramp that voltage up. And, you know, like I said, at this point, I don't care about the current because I'm not trying to use the current. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to move power rapidly, swiftly, and smoothly as possible without generating any waste energy such as heat, which would be if you're trying to draw too much power off of that transformer. Now, when you get a general understanding of what it is that I'm trying to share with you today and what I've been trying to share with everybody, then it'll make more sense to you why it is that, you know, you can't get nearly enough energy out of something as simple as a solar panel to do a lot of things because of the way that you're actually using that power off of that solar panel. Now, the general connection, which I posted a link in the Super Chat room, I will also copy it to the doggone over there to People for People chat room. And it's a diagram of how, you know, a basic solar panel is connected to your system there. And in the way that it's actually connected to your system is the actual flaw. If people started to realize this, then their solar panels were capable of doing a whole lot more than they can possibly imagine. So, if you're interested in, take a look at that that picture of the solar panel connection. It's a solar charge solar panel goes from the solar panel to a charge controller and to a battery, and then the battery goes to an inverter, and then the inverter runs your load, and through this entire process, it's hindering what that solar panel could actually be capable of. Now keep in mind, like I said earlier, transformers do not care where that power comes from. They don't care where that magnetic field comes from. But before we can get into all that, you have to first understand what the heck is going on to begin with. You know, why is these things up on the pole, and what they do, and what's the, you know, how's this whole system function? So with that said, I'm going to play some podcast today, a little bit at a time, and maybe I'll stop in and say something here and there, you know, when I find a key point that needs to be emphasized. But this first one is a how-to, or how it's made, of transformers. I've shared this video before, but like I said, the secrets are in the detail. If you understand what's going on in here, then it'll make a whole lot more sense to you. The way that some people call them pole pigs, some people call them pole transformers or whatever. There's many different terminologies for them, but it's those cans that you see up there on the power pole that are feeding power into your house. Now their primary purpose is to just take that power that's coming down that line and step it down and make it safe for your house. But in the process of that, there's some secrets in that revealed in that thing on how the primary is actually connected to that power line, and what is actually happening inside that transformer when this energy comes in there, and the fact that capacitors play a really huge role in the way that that power is actually coming to you into your house. Now see, when you're sending that power down through there, not all the power that's coming down that line is usable. For one, it's too high of a voltage and too much power for your house. If you try to hook directly to that line, it'd set fire to whatever it is you've got, because your transformers that you have inside your house are not capable of handling that much power. It'd just fry them out, and probably you in the process. But nonetheless, as that power is coming down that power line, and it goes into that transformer with just a regular style step down transformer, it wouldn't be able to keep a steady voltage at all times. You might have a surge here and there. There's power that is usable and power that is not usable when this is going, because the field is expanding and collapsing, and it's energizing from the primary to the secondary. And so that takes that high voltage and you know, basically brings it down so you can use it, but in the process it uses a trick of capacitors to take that power and store some of that energy to smooth out, to compensate for the time that you might have a loss in that the way that power is coming in at you. Like I said, there's usable power and there's non-usable power coming down that line because of the way that it reacts to that transformer. Now, this is key because what I've been showing with all these different videos about different types of systems with capacitors in there, I've got systems that have absolutely no batteries involved in it. It just uses nothing but capacitors to distribute that power where I need it. And if you know basically the secrets of how capacitors work, as long as that's already connected to the load, you don't have to worry about blowing something up. But if you fully charge a capacitor and then try to hook something, the amount of power that is released instantaneously into that load could destroy it, and more than likely will. So by understanding how to use capacitors safely, then you start to see something there. The light starts to come on, and you get that eureka moment, and you start to realize that there's different uses for different types of capacitors. There are ways in which you can actually store massive amount of power in large banks and then be able to bleed that off into multiple different systems to step it up, step it down, use that power how you like. And so when, like I said, my hopes by the time that this today shows that is you'll have a general understanding of how the system actually functions. And, you know, if you start listening in and you try to see this, visualize this in your head mechanically of how things are actually being said in these deals, and listen for the secrets that they're revealing in the process of basically teaching, you know, new linemen how systems work. And so in the process of doing that, the power company themselves actually gave a few secrets away that a lot of people don't realize. I mean, when you talk to people about electricity, you know, a lot of people know a few things, but they don't realize because, you know, they're hearing the explanation of how these work, but they're not stepping back and looking at the big picture going, aha, there's a capacitor built into that thing. And that helps to smooth out that signal that's coming in. And so with that said, that's going to help you out. If you listen to what I've tried to share with you today, it's going to benefit you in a very, very good way. So let's get into it. I'm gonna play this first podcast that has talks about how it's made. And if you're interested, I posted all the links to the videos over there in the Super Chat room, and you could go watch those later if you like, or heck, even right now if you want. But I sure hate for you to miss out on what it is that I'm trying to put this into the simplest explanation in order that I possibly can, so that by the time it's all said and done, you're gonna know how that power's coming to you and what the purpose of things are in it, because this is the key to how you can get your generators, your alternative energy devices, to do more. And keep in mind that I just said more than what they're doing now. Your wind turbines, your water turbines, your solar panels, your battery devices, whatever, how you're going to be able to get them to do a whole lot more than meets the eye. We have technologies available such as transistors and power MOSFETs and such, and other things like that, that are really super fast switching devices that can take an input, and they can take and switch this input on and off using secrets like what Tesla did, and you can ramp voltages up to ridiculous amounts. And then that voltage right there can be guided using this knowledge to wherever it is that you want. Stepped up, stepped down, and so on down the line. And now we're getting into the realm of what we call incredible efficiency. It means you're not wasting all that power with all the heat generated by the way that we use our standard electricity now. And if you understand the difference of how current flows as opposed to how the voltage flows through the system, you understand how much waste is generated by resistance it'll all start make perfect sense to you. Everything that I've been talking about on the Mad Science Show for the longest time will actually start to fall into place. The pieces of the puzzle will come together and you'll get the big picture. So let's start with this one right here.
Electric transformers. We see them everywhere, but often take for granted the big part they play in our everyday lives. Their job is to transform the high voltage from electrical power lines to the lower voltage that's suitable for home use. Without them, raw electrical power would be virtually useless to the average person. Transformers are a critical part of modern life. But did you ever stop to wonder what's inside those canisters? To build a transformer, workers start by taking paper that's coated with epoxy glue and tape it to a wooden block. Next component, an eighth of an inch thick aluminum strip. It's a metal that can withstand the heat that a high voltage current produces. As the block is rotated, the paper and the aluminum strip are wrapped around it. An aluminum bus bar, called the low voltage lead, sends low voltage current out from the transformer. Workers fold the lead and move the unit to another rotating block for more wrapping. The insulating paper has epoxy glue on both sides. This glue will later melt and bond several components in place. On the next block, a worker tapes on more epoxy paper along with epoxy-coated copper wire. He covers the paper. Then repeats the same process, forming a second layer of copper wire. He solders a high voltage lead wire to the copper wire, then rolls yet another layer of copper wire. Next, he welds on what's called the lead wire out, the wire that'll protrude from the transformer's cylinder, and attaches vinyl-coated wires that'll connect to different voltages out of the transformer. This completed unit is called the coil. Now, using electrical steel, workers build the transformer's other main component, called the core. The coil and core are tightly secured together with metal strapping, which will help to fix the assembly in the tank. Then it's into an oven, where they bake for 8 hours at 275 degrees. The heat improves insulation by removing any traces of humidity. It also melts the epoxy glue, fusing together the paper, the aluminum strip, and the copper wires. The assembly now goes into a steel tank. A rubber gasket is hammered around the perimeter, and a grounding wire is bolted on. Then three thermoplastic bushings are inserted. Workers connect the low-voltage lead to the thermoplastic bushings, then bolt the bushings to the tank. They adhere an oil filling guide to the side of the tank, then position an automated filling machine. A machine fills the tank with mineral oil, drawing a vacuum to make sure the oil disperses throughout the coil and core. The oil is used for its thermal and insulating properties. An internal fault detector will alert maintenance crews if there's a short circuit. A worker runs lead wire through the thermoplastic bushing and secures it in place. Next comes the high voltage connector. Finally, the tank cover is bolted shut. The transformation, so to speak, is finished. Before transformers go into service, they have to undergo some truly electrifying tests. This equipment simulates 145,000 volt lightning strike. Then it's into a water tank to test the transformer for leaks. If it passes muster, it could soon be appearing on a pole near you.
So that little video right there, when you look at that, you know, with prior knowledge of electricity and capacitors and induction and all that kind of stuff, it really starts to make sense. This was one of the most exciting videos that I've ever found, because I've always wondered what was inside those doggone transformers and how it is that they're doing what it is that they're doing. But with that said, we're not done yet, because now you need to understand what's going on, how that system actually takes that power into this transformer. And then he puts it down to where it will actually work in your house now. So we're going to go with this next one right here. And be patient, stay tuned with me.
Let's talk about transformers. Not the machines that transform from cars to combat robots you see in the movies, but the kind you see at the top of utility poles or on the ground in your neighborhood. Transformers are used to step electric voltage up or down before it makes its way to its final destination. Why does this need to happen? Original power distribution voltage can range from 7,200 to 24,900 volts, depending on your electric utility provider's practice, the distance to the furthest member, and the amount of load served. That's much too high a voltage for safe home or business use. Transmission lines connect the power to substations brimming with transformers and control equipment. This is the first place where they transform the voltage to safer, more manageable levels for the distribution system. The voltage then travels through distribution lines, takes one or two more steps down, and arrives at your home. Power feeds into your home's electrical outlets and lights at 120 volts, while water heaters, ranges, and HVAC systems receive 240 volts, both considerably lower than the original voltage. Here's a quick look at how transformers actually work for a typical American home. Transformers start with an iron core. On two sides of this iron core, wire is coiled. On the high voltage side, the coil is wrapped around the core many times. This side receives or produces high voltage. On the other side, the coil is wrapped around fewer times, receiving or producing lower voltage. As the electricity flows through the high voltage coil, it creates a magnetic field and induces a lower voltage in the other coil. That's how the magic of transformation takes place. Transformers are everywhere in our daily lives, not just on your utility provider's lines. Take your cell phone charger, for example. Many of these small cousins of utility transformers perform a similar function. Charging your cell phone with 120 volts will fry it instantly, so the charger converts the voltage to a more tolerable 5 volts or so. The use of electricity touches nearly every aspect of our modern lives, and we have transformers to thank for bringing it safely into our homes.
And the cool thing about those transformers is they can actually be used in reverse. Like if you got one voltage, higher voltage on the primary and a lower voltage on the secondary, you can actually pulse the secondary and make the primary the secondary and ramp the voltage up. So it's about the number of turns that's actually on there. That, like I said, that magnetic field, it doesn't care which direction it's going. It don't care where it comes from, but if you understand the basic concepts of how a transformer works, then you're a step ahead of the game as compared to the average Joe that just, you know, walks over and turns the light switch on. And now if you're into trying to figure out efficiency and so on, then you're going to be better off for, you know, this knowledge. Doggone it, I'm sitting here trying to scroll down and this stupid mouse keeps sticking. Stop it! Anyway, there it is. Alright, so with that said, apologize for that. Bear with me though, this is really good information. And I'm going to play this next one right here. It's another one on how transformers work. Alright, anytime now.
We'll also show you examples of how single-phase transformers can be connected together to provide three-phase power. Let's start by reviewing some basic information about transformers and how they work, and identifying some standard features found on single-phase distribution transformers. A transformer is an electrical device that changes the values of voltage and current. Inside a typical transformer are two windings, a primary winding and the secondary winding. Both windings are wrapped around a common metal core, and there are no physical connections between the windings. The primary winding of a transformer is rated and insulated for a specific primary voltage. Voltage is applied to the primary winding by connections to a primary distribution system. One or more insulated primary bushings mounted on the transformer housing provide the connection points between the ends of the winding and the primary system. The secondary winding of the transformers is rated and insulated for a specific secondary voltage. When energized, the secondary winding supplies voltage to a secondary load. Connections between the winding and the load are made through insulated secondary bushings. Now, even though it functions as a single unit, the secondary winding in a single-phase transformer is actually made up of two individual coils of equal size that are electrically connected together. How the two coils are connected can vary to how the transformer is used. We'll look at these various connections in more detail later on. When a source voltage is applied to the primary winding, the resulting current flow creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field cuts across the secondary winding, inducing a voltage. The ratio between the number of turns in the primary winding and the number of turns in the secondary winding determines the value of the secondary voltage that a transformer can supply to a load. Now, let's take a look at some examples of single-phase transformers that are commonly found on distribution systems. This is a single-phase, single-bushing transformer. It provides single-phase voltage, typically rated at 120, 240 volts to a secondary load. On a single-bushing transformer, the primary bushing is generally mounted on the top of the transformer housing. The bushing is insulated for a specific primary voltage and serves as a connection point between one end of the primary winding and an energized phase. In this example, a surge arrestor is also mounted on the housing to protect the transformer from damage caused by voltage surges. The other end of the primary winding is connected to a case ground located on the side of the transformer housing.
And that case ground is actually connected to the earth ground, which is really, really important. So you got one end of that primary winding connected to the transformer coming in from a single wire. That input is connected to the one end of the primary wire, and then the primary coil, and then the other end of the primary coil is actually connected to the earth ground. So keep that in mind. All right, we're still here. Kicking on another video, get a blank
spot. Transformers come in a variety of shapes and sizes, ranging from the very large to the very small. Now, there really isn't much difference between the job done by a large substation transformer and the job done by this small transformer. When it comes right down to it, regardless of size or shape, transformers do basically the same thing. A transformer is an electrical device that transforms or changes the value of voltage and current. A transformer that changes voltage from lower values to higher values is usually referred to as a step-up transformer. Step-up transformers are commonly used in transmission systems. In a distribution system, however, you're most likely going to find step-down transformers. That is, a transformer that changes voltage from higher values to lower values. In this part of the program, what we want to do is give you a basic understanding of how transformers work, and teach you how to recognize the typical types of transformers you'll find in distribution systems. We'll use this simplified diagram to identify the basic elements in a transformer and to explain how transformers work. In general, the transformers you'll find in distribution systems have three elements in common: a metal core, a primary winding, and a secondary winding. Voltage is applied to the transformer through the primary winding and taken off the transformer through the secondary winding. When voltage is applied to the primary winding, the resulting current creates a magnetic field around the core that induces a voltage in the secondary winding. The ratio between the number of turns in the primary winding and the number of turns in the secondary winding determines whether the voltage induced in the secondary has a higher or lower value than the applied voltage. In most distribution transformers, the voltage induced in the secondary winding is lower than the voltage applied to the primary winding. In this example of a step-down transformer, one end of the primary winding is grounded. A tap coming off the center of the secondary winding is also grounded. This results in one primary lead coming into the transformer and two secondary leads, plus a ground coming out of the transformer. We'll use this simplified illustration to show you how the basic elements are arranged in a typical pole-top transformer. You can recognize this type of transformer by the cylindrical housing, the large primary bushing on the top of the housing, and three secondary bushings on the side of the housing. This illustration is similar to the kinds of transformers you see on many overhead distribution systems. Both the primary and secondary bushings insulate the transformer leads as they pass through the housing. The primary winding in this transformer is supplied with primary distribution voltage from a distribution line on the pole. Primary voltage is applied through this lead that runs through the primary bushing to one end of the primary winding. The other end of the winding is tied to the transformer's housing, and an external ground is applied. The secondary or utilization voltage induced in the secondary winding is tapped off the transformer through leads that pass through the secondary bushings on the side of the housing. In this example, the lead passing through the middle bushing on the secondary side is grounded. The leads on either side are hot. The secondary leads are usually connected to wires that form a secondary bus, which supplies consumers with electricity through service drops. Here's a typical pole-top transformer. Let's identify the elements that allow you to recognize this component as a transformer. First, it has a large primary bushing on top connected to a distribution line. Second, smaller secondary bushings are located on the side of the housing. Finally, the wires coming off the secondary bushings form a secondary bus and service drop going to a customer. Now that you have a basic understanding of how transformers work, and you've seen a typical example of a pole-top transformer, let's look at some other examples of transformers that you may encounter on the job. This is also a pole-top transformer. It looks and works exactly like the one we just discussed. Except, instead of one large bushing on the top of the housing, this one has two. This bushing allows the primary lead to connect to the primary winding, just like we saw earlier. However, instead of having the other end of the primary winding grounded through the transformer housing, this type of pole-top transformer is grounded through this second bushing. Both single bushing and two bushing transformers perform the exact same job, They just look a little different. In some cases, the load demand and equipment used by a consumer requires the use of a three-phase transformer. In an overhead system, three single-phase transformers can be connected together to form a three-phase transformer. Of course, not all transformers are located overhead on utility poles. In areas that have underground distribution systems, pad mounting is a common method of installing transformers. This three-phase transformer is housed in a rectangular-shaped metal cabinet that sits on a concrete pad. All connections for the transformer are concealed within the cabinet. Single-phase pad-mounted transformers are similar in shape, but their cabinets are usually smaller in size. Inside the cabinet are the primary bushings and the secondary bushings. Somewhat less common, but still used in many underground distribution systems, are subsurface transformers. Subsurface transformers are installed underground in specially constructed vaults for protection. In shape, subsurface transformers resemble single-phase pole-top transformers. However, both the primary and secondary bushings are usually located on the top of the transformer housing. So far, we've looked at various examples of transformers found in distribution systems. Earlier in your training, you saw several examples of substation transformers. Substation transformers are usually rectangular in shape and mounted on concrete pads in a substation. Their primary and secondary bushings are usually located on the top of the transformer housing. Substation transformers are much larger than pole-top or pad-mounted transformers. The reason for this is that substation transformers are designed to handle higher voltages than distribution transformers. Substation transformers are easy to recognize because they're always located in substations and they have large bushings. Transformers are a very important part of a T&D system, because they change the value of voltage and current to meet the specific needs of the system. In this portion of the program, we've given you some basic information about how transformers work, and we've shown you some typical examples of the types of transformers that you'll see on the job. In the next part of the program, we'll go on to look at voltage regulators and capacitors.
One of the good things to note about this knowledge, if you're paying attention and you're still with me, is that even if the power grid goes down, you have all the equipment around you necessary to turn the power right back on if you so choose, if the doggone power company is unable to send that signal down the line. And so with that said, you'd also have to understand a few things about safety and such like that, but nonetheless, those systems, unless they're completely fried out, if the power company just suddenly up and fails and no longer able to send power down, and so basically all the systems are failed and there isn't nobody to get out there and repair lines and such like that, then if you got general knowledge of how these things work, and you could actually fire those transformers right back up with the knowledge that you're learning here today, so that you could still have power in your neighborhood. Now, understand that the power that's coming down that power line, is seriously dangerous. And if that thing, if you don't take the proper precautions, and for some reason that thing comes back on, then you could have issues. But what I'm saying is a worst case scenario. There is no power going to this system. It's still there. It's still made for the same purpose. So you would be able to actually turn that thing back on. Best case scenario, though, is you actually have your own transformer, and you understand a different way of using that. And that's what I'm hoping to finally get to with this process. And so I got a few more of these that I want to play. Let's see if we can get this going. This one here is about voltage regulators and capacitors.
In the last part of this program, you learned that distribution transformers are used to change primary distribution voltage to secondary voltage, which your customer can use. The value of voltage carried by a distribution line can be affected by changes in customer load demand and electrical characteristics that cause power losses. In order to compensate for these losses, voltage regulators and capacitors are used. In this part of the program, we're going to teach you how to identify voltage regulators and capacitors and give you a basic explanation of how each of these devices does its job. We'll begin with voltage regulators. A voltage regulator is an electrical device that maintains distribution voltage within a specified range of values. This simplified diagram illustrates the basic electrical components found inside of a voltage regulator. They consist of a primary winding, which is wired in series to a secondary winding. The series connection causes the primary winding to also function as part of the secondary winding. A tap-changing mechanism connects the voltage regulator to the distribution system through taps. On our simplified diagram, 5 taps are shown. In an actual voltage regulator, there may be 30 or more taps. When voltage is applied to the primary winding, the resulting current flow induces a voltage in the secondary winding. This is similar to the operation of the transformer we looked at earlier. However, unlike transformers, the series connection between the windings causes the primary winding to also function as part of the secondary winding. Depending on which tap that connects the voltage regulator to the distribution system, the value of voltage leaving the regulator may be greater than, less than, or equal to the voltage applied to the primary winding. The voltage supplied to and tapped off voltage regulators is primary distribution voltage. All the regulator does is adjust the voltage within a specified range of values in order to correct for drops in voltage caused by changes in load demand and characteristics of distribution lines. Now that you have a basic understanding of what a voltage regulator does, let's see what one looks like in a distribution system. This simplified diagram illustrates what a typical voltage regulator looks like. The electrical components are contained inside a cylindrical housing that is usually longer than the housing on a typical distribution transformer. On the top of the housing are 3 bushings. This bushing allows the primary lead from the distribution line to connect to the primary winding. This connection is usually designated as line on a regulator. This bushing connects the lead from the tap changing mechanism to the distribution line. This bushing is usually designated as load on the regulator. The voltage regulator is grounded through this 3rd bushing. 2 additional features found on most voltage regulators are a control panel and a tap position indicator. We'll look at these in more detail in just a minute. Here's a voltage regulator installed on a utility pole. Notice the characteristic shape of the housing and the 3 large bushings located on top of the housing. Unregulated primary voltage is applied to the primary winding through this bushing marked line. Regulated primary voltage is supplied to the distribution system through this bushing marked load. The 3rd bushing is connected to ground. A nameplate on the regulator housing provides specific information about the capacity and wiring design of the regulator. Located on the side of the regulator is the tap position indicator. The indicator consists of a faceplate calibrated to show both increases and decreases in voltage. In this example, a primary pointer and 2 memory pointers are also a part of this indicator. The 0 on the faceplate indicates a neutral tap position. This means that the unregulated line voltage and the regulated load voltage are at the same value. The numbers to the right of zero indicate the position of the tap-changing mechanism when the value of the load voltage is being increased over the value of the line voltage applied to the regulator. The numbers to the left of the zero indicate the position of the tap-changing mechanism when the value of the load voltage is being decreased from the value of the line voltage being applied. This pointer indicates the actual position of the tap-changing mechanism at any point in time. The memory pointers on each side of the pointer indicate the highest and lowest tap position reached by the regulator since the last time the regulator was inspected, and the memory pointers were reset. This wire connects the voltage regulator to its control panel, which is located on the pole near the ground. Inside the panel is an analog computer. The computer is programmed to respond to changes in line voltage and cause the regulator to increase or decrease the value of the regulated voltage within a specified range of values. One way of identifying a voltage regulator is the manner in which it fits into the distribution system. A disc or other insulator is usually installed in the distribution line near the regulator. Unregulated voltage is applied to the regulator from a tap on this side of the insulator. A wire runs from the tap through an isolation switch to the line side of the regulator. Regulated voltage is supplied to the distribution system through a wire connected to the load side of the regulator. The wire also runs through the isolation switch to a tap on this side of the insulator. In most cases, each phase wire of a distribution line is attached to a separate voltage regulator. The regulators may be mounted on separate utility poles like these, or in some cases, three regulators may be mounted together on a platform. Voltage regulators are an important part of a distribution system because they ensure that a customer will be supplied with electricity at a usable voltage. Voltage regulators and transformers are primarily used to affect the voltage in a distribution system. Capacitors are used to affect power.
Okay, I'm going to pause that just for a second. What you just heard about voltage regulators, the way that those things are designed, are almost like self-regulating transformers that, if they need more power because of the way that these are actually run with the primary and the secondary in series with multiple taps in between there. Remember what we said about on the secondary, how many turns of winding that you have on there will determine the secondary voltage on that. And so with all these different taps, you can actually tap in to get higher or lower voltages on the secondary. So, it almost works like a variac that, speeds up and slows down, or, basically changes the voltage on the secondary, which is, if you look at a variac and a voltage regulator, the way that this one was just explained, they're pretty much the same exact thing. They tap into different sections of the secondary in order to increase or lower the voltage. So, with that said, that knowledge right there of how them things actually function could be beneficial, if you ever needed to, be able to step up or step down that power and have actual control over it, as opposed to one that was just, primary at set winding and secondary at another set winding. And so with that said, it's really brilliant information. And like I said before, the secrets are in the details. If you're following me so far and you're paying attention to what's going on, all of what I've been trying to tell everybody for a long time is going to start making perfect sense. Now let's get into the rest of this with the capacitors.
By multiplying the amount of voltage applied to an AC circuit by the amount of current flowing through the circuit gives you the amount of power in the circuit. Now, power is a complex topic, which you'll learn about in great detail later on in your training. For our purposes right now, you need to understand that there are several different types of power. Some of the power is usable, and some is not. In a distribution system, which is basically an AC circuit, voltage and current constantly rise and fall, ideally when voltage and current rise and fall at the same time, usable power is produced. In reality, however, voltage and current often rise and fall at different times. This produces reactive power, which is not usable, and reduces the overall efficiency of the system. Reactive power can be a problem in distribution systems because it affects the amount of power that can be supplied to a customer. To compensate for reactive power, capacitors are often used. In this part of the program, we'll give you a basic explanation of how capacitors work and teach you to recognize them. A capacitor is an electrical device that can accept a charge, store it, and release it. The manner in which capacitors charge and discharge increases the efficiency of a distribution system so that more usable power is available for customer use. This simplified diagram illustrates the basic parts of a single-phase capacitor. It consists of two plates separated by insulation housed in an oil-filled container. One of the capacitor plates is connected through this bushing to the distribution line. The other plate is connected through this bushing to ground. In an AC circuit, voltage continually increases and decreases. As voltage increases, the capacitor charges. This means that one plate becomes positively charged and the other plate becomes negatively charged. When voltage begins decreasing, the capacitor discharges. The capacitor continues to charge and discharge as the cycle repeats. Capacitors are very easy to recognize because they are square or rectangular in shape. The number of bushings on top of the capacitor may vary. These are three-phase capacitors. In most cases, you'll find capacitors connected together in banks. Here, individual capacitors are connected together to meet the load requirements of a specific service area. The ability of a capacitor to counteract reactive power does a great deal to improve the overall efficiency of a distribution system. A capacitor's ability to store a charge, however, can present a considerable safety hazard to you and other T&D personnel. Capacitors do an excellent job of storing an electrical charge. In fact, they will remain charged even after they are isolated from a system. When working on capacitors, it is extremely important to your safety that you follow your company's procedures for discharging the capacitor before starting any work. This will ensure your safety and the safety of others working with you. In this part of the program, we've shown you what voltage regulators and capacitors look like, and we've explained the job each performs. Voltage regulators keep voltage within a specified range of values. Capacitors improve the overall efficiency of a distribution system by compensating for reactive power. In the next part of this program, we'll begin discussing how distribution systems are laid out and how they are protected.
All righty, now we're getting into actually how the system is all set up and basically brings the power to you. That was the equipment side of the deal. Let's go with this one right here. This one here is about protected devices.
The job of a power company is to provide its customers with a reliable source of electricity. In order to accomplish this task, a number of protective devices are used on distribution systems to protect the system and equipment from damage and customers from an interruption in service. What we're going to do in the last two parts of this program is to give you a basic overview of some of the protective devices used on distribution systems and give you a general explanation of how a coordinated protective system works. We'll begin by looking at two protective devices that are found in most distribution systems. circuit breakers, and fuses. A circuit breaker is essentially nothing more than a large switch that can interrupt current flow through a line. When the circuit breaker is closed, the lines attached to the circuit breaker are energized. When the switch is open, the lines are de-energized. For the most part, circuit breakers are located inside substations. As you'll recall from the last part of this program, transmission lines supply a substation with electricity. The transmission voltage is changed to distribution voltage by substation transformers that supply electricity to a substation bus. The substation bus then supplies electricity at primary distribution voltage to feeders. In many systems, circuit breakers are installed between the substation bus and the individual feeders. Generally, there is one circuit breaker for each feeder. Let's take a look at a simplified drawing of a distribution system to see how circuit breakers fit into the scheme of things. On this drawing, we have a transmission line, a substation transformer, the substation bus, three circuit breakers, and three feeders. Again, for simplicity, we're showing the feeders as solid lines. In reality, the feeder is normally composed of three phase wires and a neutral. Most circuit breakers have indication of when the breaker is open and when it is closed. For our purposes, we'll use red to indicate that the circuit breaker is closed and the feeder is energized, and green to indicate that the breaker is open and the feeder is de-energized. The basic purpose of a circuit breaker is to protect its associated feeder from damage due to fault. Now, there are a number of different types of faults. For our explanation, we'll consider only a ground fault. A ground fault is a current flow path to ground that is not a normal part of a system's design. For example, under certain conditions, a tree branch coming in contact with a distribution line can cause current flow to ground. A malfunctioning component on a utility pole can also cause a ground fault. We'll return to our drawing and see what happens when a fault occurs on a feeder. Now, keep in mind that we've slowed down the sequence of events for our explanation. In reality, protective devices are designed to respond very rapidly in order to protect the system. At this moment, the distribution system is operating normally. All circuit breakers are closed, and all feeders are energized. Let's suppose that a tree branch sways against this feeder, causing a ground fault. When a ground fault occurs, the current carried by the feeder has a flow path to ground that is not a normal part of the system's design. In most cases, this causes the circuit breaker to open, momentarily de-energizing the feeder. The other feeders and circuit breakers in the system will be unaffected by this action. In general, circuit breakers are designed to open and then close automatically after a specific period of time has elapsed. If the fault is temporary, as in the case of a tree branch swaying into a feeder, it usually clears fairly quickly. When the circuit breaker closes, service is restored, and the system continues to operate normally. However, if the fault does not clear, the current carried by the feeder will continue to flow to ground. This will cause the circuit breaker to open again for a period of time, and then close. In some systems, this pattern of opening and closing will continue until the fault is cleared. In most systems, however, the circuit breaker is designed to open and close a set number of times and then lock out, that is, remain open until it is reset manually. Circuit breakers provide excellent protection against damage due to faults on feeders. Circuit breakers can also protect laterals that are tapped off of feeders. However, in many systems, fuses are installed between the feeder and the laterals to provide additional protection. In this example, the feeder supplies a three-phase lateral and the single phase lateral. This is what a typical fuse looks like. It consists of two contacts, one tapped off a feeder and the other connected to a lateral, and a hinged fuse. In the closed position, the fuse provides a flow path for electricity at a primary distribution voltage to flow from the feeder to the lateral. In the open position, the fuse separates from this contact and swings down, interrupting the flow of electricity to the lateral. Unlike circuit breakers that can open and close automatically, a fuse is designed to open and remain open whenever the value of the current carried by it exceeds its design capacity. In most distribution systems, circuit breakers and fuses are designed to work in a coordinated manner for system protection. We'll use a simplified drawing of a feeder with fused laterals to see how this coordinated effort is achieved. In this drawing, we have a circuit breaker connected to a feeder with three laterals. The laterals are supplying electricity to residential communities, office buildings, and industrial facilities. At present, the circuit breaker and fuses are closed, and both the feeder and the laterals are energized. If a fault occurs on the feeder, the circuit breaker will sense the fault and open, momentarily de-energizing the feeder and the laterals. If the fault clears, service will be restored when the circuit breaker again closes. The fuses will not be affected in any way. However, if a fault occurs on one of the laterals, slightly different events take place. When the fault first occurs, the circuit breaker will sense it and open. If the fault clears, service will return to normal when the breaker automatically closes. However, if the fault remains, the circuit breaker automatically shifts to a different mode of operation. The second time the circuit breaker senses the fault, it delays opening for a short period of time. The actual amount of delay varies from system to system. Regardless of the system, however, the delay provides enough time for the fuse connecting the lateral to the feeder to open. When the fuse opens, the faulted lateral is isolated from the distribution system. The circuit breaker will then open and close. When the breaker closes, service will be restored to all parts of the system except the faulted lateral. This process is known as sectionalizing, and it provides protection to the distribution system and its components against damage due to faults. It also protects the majority of customers serviced by the system against outages. Circuit breakers and fuses are just two of the many protective devices used in distribution systems. In the next part of the program, we'll look at some other types of protective devices. But before we leave the topic of circuit breakers and fuses, let's review some of the points we've covered. We said that circuit breakers are basically automatic switches that can interrupt the flow of electricity through a distribution feeder. Circuit breakers have the capability of opening and closing automatically, and when used as part of a coordinated protection system, they can operate in a number of different modes. Fuses are used to connect laterals and feeders. A fuse can interrupt the flow of electricity through a line, but in most cases cannot automatically close to restore service. In a coordinated system, circuit breakers protect feeders from damage due to faults, and fuses protect laterals from damage due to faults in a process known as sectionalizing. Sectionalizing is simply the ability of a power company to isolate a part of a system that is faulted while continuing to provide service to the majority of its customers. We'll stop so that you can review the material in your text on circuit breakers and fuses and sectionalizing. And when we come back, we'll look at some other protective devices.
Okay, that's very important information, because if, you know, you like what they're doing with them is, say you got three sections of town, And if the tree branch falls on this side of town, it can separate the fault from the circuit so that the other two parts of the town don't lose power. So it's a pretty smart deal how they did that. You're in all actuality, the way that your house is wired up is basically the same thing. Each room would have its own circuit breaker, and you know, each set of lines down there. Some of them might even have what they call GFIs, which are ground fault indicators. It means if you know, that some of that power is interrupted, shorted out somewhere, that it will automatically recognize that fault in the system and kick that breaker, just the outlet itself off. And so, you know, in a serious situation, it would actually kick the entire breaker off. So whatever outlets or switches were connected to that GFI system, they would all go down. And so you could have as many as a whole string of outlets and switches that don't work anymore. Because they're in one portion of the area, one portion of that wiring system, there was a short somewhere, and so it shut the entire portion of the system, while at the same time leaving other GFI systems on because they didn't detect a ground fault. So it basically the same sectionalizing that they're talking about right there is built into most houses and mobile homes setups, so that you don't lose entire power through the entire house because of one section failing somewhere. So with that said, keep all this information in mind, and I encourage you to, if you have opportunity, to go download all these videos that I had posted for future reference, in case worst case scenario. You could always throw them on your laptop and watch these videos to have another understanding, and even this podcast for that matter, for the explanation that I'm giving you, so that you could use this in the future. So this podcast and all these videos right here could be beneficial for you, in say a grid down type of scenario where you needed to have an understanding of how this power system actually works. Because that's the whole thing. You're at the mercy of the power company, because you're not one of the linemen that go out there and fix stuff, and you don't have an understanding of what's actually wrong. If the power outage is from the actual power plant itself, something happened, explosion at the power plant and shut the entire power grid down, well, there is no power to sectionalize and keep anybody off. Everybody's off. You have a blackout or a brownout or whatever, And so knowing how this deal is, if the power plant is never able to come back up, you still have equipment in your neighborhood that is connected to how many ever neighbors you got. And so if that line is completely cut away from that, then you could introduce your own power source without having to worry about somebody else doing the same thing the next side over, because you wouldn't want to backfeed some power and hurt somebody trying to repair a line or anything like that. So you have to know all the precautions and the safety, especially when you're getting around capacitors and stuff like that. But this type of knowledge, the way that your house is already set up, your house is set up to receive power. There's no transformer before your house, with the exception of the one that's on the pole. So the power that's coming off straight off that transformer on the pole is coming straight into your breaker box and your fuse panels and all that. And then from that point on, you regulate that power with the transformers that you plug in, that you use for your devices and such. But understanding that, you got a miniature version of the big version inside your house. So when that 120 volts or 220 volts AC is coming into your house, you're doing the same exact thing that the power company is actually doing. Your system set up, it has grounds that go down to the earth ground. It has breaker systems, and you have capacitors in most of your devices out there nowadays. And even in some of the older devices as well, depending on like electric motors or whatever, start and run capacitors and such. But either way, that energy is being pushed around in the same exact way that the power company is actually sending it to you. So once you understand how that power is actually coming to you to begin with, now you can get into how your alternative energy devices are actually going to be able to work. See, it's really super simple to generate high voltage. Ridiculously simple to generate high voltage. It's a little slightly different when we're talking about current. When you ramp the voltage up, the current goes down. When you drop the voltage down, the current comes up, and there's a happy medium in between there. And so if you understand how the actual generator itself is functioning, well, when it's pushing that power out, you know, you're sending an AC wave down the line, or even a DC wave, you know, a DC generator. You can still use a DC generator to pulse an AC transformer, if you understand what it is that I've been trying to share with you. So, but before we get into that, I'm going to go ahead and play this part two of this thing right here, because some of the information, actually all of the information in here, is worthy of paying attention to. But once again, I encourage you that if you have the opportunity, go back through the list of all these videos that I posted right here, and download those videos, put them in a safe place, and even this podcast, so that you can refer to it later if you ever need it, even when it comes down to your projects for generating alternative energy. Because when we get down to the meat of the whole entire show today, and if you follow me so far, and you got a basic knowledge in your head now of how this system is sending power to you to begin with, now it starts to become ridiculously simple of what the capabilities of this equipment already is. They like I said, in every single one of your neighborhoods, you have power transformers, and if you understand how those things work, those things could be useful if an entire power grid failure went down. You could fire your doggone lights right back up without any problems. And if you had your own miniature version of this system, you could take your solar panels, your wind turbines, your water turbines, or a combination of all of the above, with your battery banks and understanding of how this all functions, and you could have your own power generating plant. And do it in a more efficient manner than what they're doing. See, they're sending anywhere from 7,000 volts and on and up down those power lines. You don't need that much power. You don't need near that much power. You need 120 or 240 volts or whatever. 120, 220, or 240, whichever your needs are. That's all you need. And it is so ridiculously simple to produce that amount of voltage with a whole lot less input, a lot less effort than what they're doing. See, the key is they're providing multiple people out there. And you also heard in there talking about power. There's different types of power, usable power and not usable power. This is a key factor in understanding why it is that capacitors are actually used in this system, and the safety devices thereafter, so that you're not causing any damage, you know, like starting a wire fire. Your breaker switch will kick off, and when it gets a short to it, because now you got too much power trying to go to a dead short, and it's generating a lot of heat, and so it'll actually burn through the insulation and start a fire. If your circuit breakers or your fuses don't work, well, that's the same exact thing, same exact concept of what's going on in your house is what the power company is doing. So like I said before, folks, the secrets are in the details. If you pay attention to this show, and I can't express this enough, I encourage you to download this podcast. Download each one of these videos and save them for future reference, because when I get my new lab together, I'm going to show you in real time exactly what it is that I've been showing you, and how ridiculously simple. I've already, in some of the videos that I've been showing, showed how energy travels. Like I mentioned earlier, I've got systems that have absolutely no batteries involved in the system. I'm using the power input to pulse a signal at a certain hertz range at only 9 volts, and I'm ramping that up, and I'm storing that power, and I'm bringing it back around. I'm dropping it down using capacitors and, you know, transformers and such. I can step it up, step it down. I can move it around to different places, whatever. But it's all ridiculously simple. And like I said, you don't need near the amount of power that you think you do in order to run the things that you run. But when we get down to the basics of it, and I'm able to show you in the videos and the live streams that I have planned for my YouTube channel and the future, when you see how ridiculously simple it is, and you're going to want to hook your solar panels up in a completely different fashion, in which case you will get a lot more power. You'll make those solar panels so incredibly efficient, and it'll blow your doors off. So let's keep on rolling with this one right here. This is part 2, protective devices. All right, come on.
In the last part of this program, we showed you how circuit breakers and fuses could be used to protect the distribution system from damage due to faults, and the customers it supplies from outages. In a coordinated protection system, circuit breakers and fuses work in conjunction with one another, so that a portion of the distribution system can be isolated for service, while the majority of the system continues to receive electricity. This process is known as sectionalizing. Circuit breakers and fuses are not the only devices that can be used to protect distribution systems from damage due to faults. Many systems also use reclosers and sectionalizers for fault protection. This is an example of a three-phase recloser connected to a distribution feeder. A recloser is an automatic switch that can interrupt or establish the flow of electricity through a distribution line. Reclosers differ from circuit breakers in that they are generally smaller and light enough to be mounted on distribution poles. Some power companies use reclosers in place of circuit breakers in their distribution systems. In other cases, both circuit breakers and reclosers may be used. Another protective device that is generally used in conjunction with reclosers is a sectionalizer. A sectionalizer, like a recloser, is also basically a switch. The difference between a sectionalizer and a recloser is that most sectionalizers cannot open an energized line. In most cases, a line must be de-energized before the sectionalizer can open. In many systems, sectionalizers are used to connect feeders and laterals. Let's again use a simplified drawing of a single feeder with three laterals to demonstrate how sectionalizers and reclosers work. On this drawing, we'll...
I want to pause that for a second while I got this thought in my head, because I want you to be able to understand something, and I don't want to lose this thought. With a transformer, when you pulse the primary and that field expands, it induces a magnetic field through the core that transfers to the secondary and then basically energizes the secondary and produces electricity. Well, as well as when that primary, the field collapses in it, it pushes power back in the opposite direction, that back EMF, and so that... When that power is coming down the power line, it goes in, it pulses the primary, some of that energy bounces back, goes back down that line, and so these things are actually bouncing off of each other all the way up and down this line and helping the process of keeping these transformers running like that. So I'll have to show you a practical demonstration of what I just explained to you, but... it'll blow your doors off whenever you understand what it is that I'm saying. Let's keep rolling with this.
Replace the circuit breaker in the system with a recloser, and we'll replace the fuses on the laterals with sectionalizers. At present, the system is operating normally, and both the feeder and the laterals are energized. If a fault occurs on the feeder, the recloser will operate in a similar manner to that of a circuit breaker. That is, it will sense the fault and open, momentarily de-energizing the feeder. If the fault clears, the recloser will automatically energize the line after a specific period of time has passed. If the fault does not clear, the recloser will again sense the fault and open to de-energize the line. In most cases, the recloser can be programmed to open and close a set number of times before locking out. Once a recloser has locked out, substation or T&D personnel must clear the fault and reset the recloser before the feeder can be energized. Sectionalizers are used to connect laterals to feeders to provide fault protection. However, if a fault occurs on a lateral protected by a sectionalizer, a different process is used for sectionalizing. In this case, if a fault occurs on this lateral, the recloser will sense the fault and open, de-energizing the feeder. If the fault clears, the system will be returned to normal. However, if the fault continues, the recloser will again open, and it will remain open for a longer period of time. This time delay is enough to cause the sectionalizer to open, isolating the faulted lateral. When the recloser again energizes the line, service is restored to the feeders and all but the faulted lateral. What we've just demonstrated is a second example of sectionalizing. The basic difference between using circuit breakers and fuses for sectionalizing, or reclosers and sectionalizers, is whether or not the feeder is energized when a faulted lateral is isolated. Circuit breakers, fuses, reclosers, and sectionalizers provide coordinated protection against damage due to faults and consumer outages in a distribution system. If a problem develops in part of a distribution system, only those customers serviced by the part of the system with the problem will experience an outage. The majority of the customers will continue to receive service.
All right, once again, that's no different than what your fuse panel is actually doing in your house. So if you blow a breaker on one side, then that means the rest of your house is still functioning, and it basically isolates that device. That's what this sectionalizer thing does. And so, once again, this information is really important. If you have an understanding of how the power company is actually sending the power to you, how that grid actually works, it's going to make it a lot easier for your alternative energy devices to be able to be utilized. It's ridiculously simple to make high voltage, and so with that said, those transformers, they don't need high current in order to be able to pulse that transformer. They're utilizing high current. They're designed to be able to withstand a lot of high current. They also have protection devices that will, you know, surge protectors that will, if it gets too much power, it'll actually short itself directly to ground. You know, jump across the spark gap and then basically take that power away from it, like a lightning strike or whatever. And you've seen in the actually how it's made video that, you know, that's how that system is. That they test them with a certain amount of voltage for over charge protection. So if it gets over this particular voltage, it will literally leap across that spark gap and shut that system down, you know, sending that power elsewhere so that it doesn't damage the transformer. So that's a plus. And so, like I said, if you got an opportunity, download all these videos that I posted here today and download this podcast for future reference, because whenever I get the new lab together, I'm really going to be showing you some really awesome stuff and put all this stuff into perspective as I show you real time what it is that I've been trying to say to you all along. Anyway, let's finish this one out here. There's a little bit left of it.
Faults are a typical problem that occurs in a distribution system. Another problem is lightning. Lightning, striking on or near a distribution line, usually produces a surge in voltage that results in increased current flow. This means that the value of the current flowing through the line is considerably higher than what the line is designed to handle. If the increased current flow is allowed to reach a piece of distribution equipment, the equipment may be seriously damaged. To prevent this from happening, many systems use surge arresters to protect their equipment. Here, a surge arrester is mounted on the side of a distribution transformer. A surge arrester is a device that provides a current flow path to ground under abnormal conditions. In this illustration, the surge arrester is connected to the primary bushing by a wire. Inside the surge arrester are a series of gaps. Normal distribution voltage is not high enough to cause current flowing through the line to jump the gap and flow to ground. However, a voltage surge created by lightning striking on or near the line causes current to jump the gaps. With this type of system, excessive current is directed around distribution equipment to ground, while normal current is allowed to flow through the distribution equipment. Another method of protecting a distribution system from the effects of lightning is a static wire. A static wire is a cable that runs along the top of many utility poles. Static wires are grounded and provide what is termed a cone of protection for a distribution system. Lightning striking in the vicinity of the cone follows the path of least resistance to ground. The static wire provides a much easier path for current flow than the wires and components in a distribution system. Surge arresters and static wires provide a harmless method by which voltage surges and the resulting increase in current flow can be disposed of, rather than allowing the surge to dissipate in equipment and lines, which could cause serious damage. As we indicated earlier, each of the components we've discussed will be explained in more detail in later programs. Right now, let's review what we've covered in this program. The purpose of this program has been to provide you with a general overview of the components and equipment that make up a typical distribution system, and a basic understanding of how each piece of equipment works. We began by defining a distribution system as all of the components of a T&D system that allow power to flow from a substation to a consumer. We showed you how substation transformers change transmission voltage to distribution voltage, and how distribution transformers change distribution voltage to utilization voltage that a customer can use. We then went on to explain how voltage regulators maintain distribution voltage within an acceptable range of values, and how capacitors help improve the efficiency of a distribution system. Then we showed you how feeders, laterals, and service drops link the substation with the consumer in a variety of ways. Finally, we looked at protective devices that help maintain a continuity of service to the customer and isolate problem areas from the system without interrupting service to the rest of the system. And we showed you how surge arresters and static wires provide protection from the effects of lightning. Now, this is only the beginning of what you'll need to know and understand about the components and equipment in a distribution system. In later programs, you'll look at each component in specific detail. For now, review the material that we've covered in your text and answer the questions.
Alrighty then. So, that gives you a basic understanding of how that entire system works from start to finish. So, with that said, the power that you're getting down the power line, like I said, the power line itself, that's not usable power. It's coming in at ridiculously high voltages because they have to supply multiple different customers. And they have safety systems in place so that maybe a section gets knocked out, it doesn't knock out the rest of them. But nonetheless, all this information if you get the basic understanding of it, everything that I'm saying from this point on will make perfect sense to you, that you will be able to generate power in a worst case scenario, you know, even without you know changing anything in your house. Maybe just building yourself a custom transformer and a circuit to actually drive that transformer. So earlier I mentioned that I posted a link to a picture in the Super Chat room, and over there, People for People, it's a solar panel connection where it shows the solar panel, positive and negative, connected to charge controller. Now, the charge controller, it restricts how much power can actually come out of that charge controller at any given time. So it is one of the first flaws in the system right there. That charge controller is basically stepping the power that solar panel is actually capable of. A different type of system that would use that solar panel in a different manner, such as a circuit board, that would take the power off of that solar panel and pulse that directly into a transformer. From that point on, you can use transformers and capacitors and such to step that voltage down, and you could even use doggone rectifiers to regulate the power to charge in your batteries and such. So there's methods by which you could actually do that without that actual charge controller and be more efficient. When that solar panel is kicking out power, it's kicking out a lot more than it actually needs to charge that battery. But it has to be changed, from AC or whatever, the pulse wave or whatever. It has to change that power, drop it down, and then be able to regulate that battery by determining how much power that battery actually has. And then, letting more power in from the solar panel. So your solar panel not being used to its maximum potential. But if you had a circuit after the solar panel that took that power and basically did the same thing that a transistor or MOSFET, power MOSFET's capable of, you can take that power and pulse directly into a transformer right off of that solar panel, and get that transformer to ramp that voltage up or to drop it back down. Now, the charge controllers, don't get me wrong, they work all right for what to do, but they're not nearly as efficient as they actually could be. But from that point on, now you're taking that power, which is the DC power that is actually charging that battery, and from in between that charge controller and the battery is another flaw. That charge controller can only send so much power to that battery, and it will get feedback, and it'll have to shut itself down in order to protect itself from the power from that battery. And so in between there, you got a flaw. If you had a buffer system in between the battery and that charge controller, someplace for that excess energy to be stored until it's actually needed, then it would protect the battery and the charge controller at the same exact time. From that point on, you got a battery that then in turn goes to an inverter system. Now, this inverter system takes the DC power and does exactly what I mentioned that a extra circuit coming off of that solar panel could do to charge a transformer. Inside the inverter, it takes that DC and it takes power MOSFETs or transistors to pulse a transformer inside that inverter. So you've got a loss of power in this system because of all the stages that you got to go through to get to the doggone inverter to take that DC power and then turn that DC power into AC so that you can use it to run your appliances. So going directly from the solar panel to a circuit that is going to turn the switch on and off rapidly and pulse the primary of a transformer directly, and then pulling that power off and running it to whether you want to charge your battery through a bridge rectifier or whichever, but either way, in between every stage of this, you want a system of capacitors, a bank of capacitors, to act as a buffer between it. So between your solar panel and your circuit that you're going to be running your pulse with, you want a bank of capacitors in between that, so that any excess power that solar panel is trying to push out, it has more than enough room to store that power. And then from that point, whatever the circuit can't use, it still stays in that storage bank. And from after the circuit, between the circuit and the transformer, you got another buffer that will have any power that transformer can't accept. It will hold that power there and keep it stable from the solar panel to the circuit to the transformer, and then at every stage there in between. So that you take that solar panel and you're getting the maximum amount of efficiency out of it. The same exact concept would apply if you were running, say, a wind turbine or whatever. And it's not limited to only one of these at a time. You could have all of them running at the same exact time, and whatever the capability that doggone solar panel or that wind turbine or hydroelectric turbine, whatever, whatever the maximum output, you will be able to use all of that energy as opposed to only portions of that energy. So that you're not back feeding power back into the deal. It's given it a smooth path to go. It's given it a buffer between every stage of the deal, so that you're not, whatever that light bulb can't accept, it's still there. It's still in storage, waiting to be used. And you're just keeping a steady current flow all the way through the entire system. When you look at these transformers of how they're actually designed, they have built-in capacitors that help to smooth out that incoming signal to ensure that you have stable power on the opposite side. And then from that stage on, it's the same thing until it finally gets up to your house. And once it comes out of your house, then your system might be slightly different on the other side. But you could still use these same exact concepts in your house to take any excess power that electric fan can't run and keep it on standby in storage until it can move somewhere down the line. You take that, let another appliance use some of that power. And once you find that sweet spot in there, all that energy that's coming down that line is going to be incredibly efficient. So the thing that I'm trying to get to is, it's not that we don't have enough power, it's that we're not using it properly. We're not having an understanding of how that power is actually coming down that power line at more power than you can use. The power company has an understanding of it, so they have been able to use the concepts that I've been telling you in order to be able to supply more customers and more efficiently because of the way they're generating that power. When the primary pulses, it expands, the field collapses, it induces a magnetic field into the secondary, and it steps the power down or steps it up, determining on whatever your needs are. And then when that field collapses, some of that energy makes it back out to that wire again and goes on down the line and does the same thing. So you got a lot of stuff going on in those power lines, more than the common understanding of how electricity actually works. They don't teach this kind of stuff in school. They don't teach this kind of stuff in the deal. But if you, like I said, the secrets are in the details. If you have a mechanical understanding of how all this stuff works, whether it be water pressure, air pressure, or electricity, then you can get the maximum amount of efficiency out of that. When you put your thumb over a garden hose, that power behind that is still there. You still have all that volume, access to all that volume. If you have your finger over the garden hose, you restrict that and it ramps that pressure up and squirts the water farther across your yard than it would be if it was just coming directly out of the deal. That's the difference between current and voltage, volume and pressure, so on down the line. So if you have an understanding of how water works, how electricity works, and how air pressure works, it's all the same exact concepts. And with that said, you can get work done if you know what you're doing with just the voltage portion of it. You're moving that voltage. Voltage is a wonderful thing when it comes down to electricity, because it's not meeting the resistance. It doesn't have the same drawbacks as trying to shove a lot of current into something. When you shove a lot of current into something, you generate heat. That heat is what eventually builds up and destroys whatever. Your circuit breakers, when they get too hot, they'll kick off. And so when they cool down, you can reset that circuit. And unless there's another dead short instantaneously heating it back up, then, you know, it'll come back on. So that's how we keep from damaging stuff in our houses. That's how they keep from damaging the equipment on the way to get the power to you. But then, like I said, the secrets are in the details there. If you paid attention to what I'm saying right here, everything that I show you from this point on when it comes to high voltage and why it is that I say I don't care about current watts and amps at this stage isn't because I'm trying to change the math or trying to change the physics or anything like that. It's because I have a mechanical understanding of how this power is actually functioning and doing what it is that it does. And you don't need near the amount of power to pulse that primary that you think you do. It doesn't take a lot of current to pulse that primary the way you think it does. And so if you understand the differences in DC current and AC current, pulse DC or whatever, and you take the best... What I'm doing on that signal generator is I'm pulsing a square wave. You know, and the square wave seems to be a really strong punch every time it pulses that deal. So I'm pulsing, starting with a 5 volt input, but in reality, I'm actually starting with 110, 120 volts. I got a little step down transformer which goes to a USB cord that runs a DDS signal generator, and I got it set at 60 hertz on a square wave. And the output is around about 9 volts output that is pulsing a microwave oven transformer primary. That power then in turn is inducing the current into the secondary that is ramping the voltage up. It's dropping the current down, but it's ramping the voltage up. And the voltage is all I need at this point in the game. I don't need the current at this point in the game. But I can get it back later because I have an understanding of how to store that power in such a manner that by the time I get around when I need that amount of current, I have access to it. So I'm running this output of the microwave oven transformer with mostly voltage alone, and I'm using this voltage to go through a storage bank, which is start capacitors that are normally kicked out of the circuit because they don't like current. All right, and what they use them to start the motor, electric motors on your different devices and stuff, so it gives that instant kick, so to speak. And so from that point on, once the motor gets up to running, it kicks that out of the circuit and uses a run capacitor, which is designed to be able to handle more current. And then from that point, your motor's running. So from the bank of start capacitors, I'm taking that high voltage AC wave and running it through a bridge rectifier that is rated at 100 amps at 1,000 volts. It's maximum 1,000 volts at 100 amps is maximum that it can handle, and I'm not even nowhere near that. And so that bridge rectifier stays perfectly cool. And it will do the same exact thing with just voltage. All it does is it only allows the electron flow to go in one direction, making DC current. Changing that AC wave to a DC current wave or whatever. And from that point on, on my output with my positive and negative side, I charge up DC capacitor bank, another buffer in between everything. And off of that DC capacitor bank, I can have as many capacitors as I want. The larger the bank, the better. And as that thing is charging up, I can measure the voltage of that deal, and I'm up to 80 some odd volts, or up to 90 volts on my power that I have now, starting off from a 5 volt input, essentially from that USB charging system. And off of those capacitor banks, I can take each capacitor individually, and I can bleed off power from each individual one, and then start running them into what they call boost capacitors or supercapacitor technology, that then in turn acts more like a battery. You can run boost caps, and you can run them like batteries. You can charge them up and basically use them like you would as a regular lead acid battery, or nickel cadmium, or lithium ion, or whatever. And either way, or nickel metal hydride, any of the batteries that you can think about, the chemistry in those batteries, you can use these new types of capacitors like they were batteries. You can completely replace all the other lead acid batteries and all that kind of stuff with these type of capacitors. Now, don't get me wrong, you can still use those batteries in the circuit, but at that point, when you get these capacitors charged up as a buffer between and after, before and after the battery, the only thing that battery is there for at that point in the game is a maintainer. It just maintains a constant power to it. And so all that energy is just skimming right across the top of the battery, keeping the battery topped off, just like flowing water from one bucket to the next and to the next bucket over. And once that one middle bucket's filled up, then the rest of that just keeps on going down the line to the next bucket in line or whatever. So that from that point, you can keep that battery charged up, but that battery is just there to maintain. It's not there. You're not actually running your load off of it. You're running your load off of the energy that's coming off of the capacitor bank on the opposite side of that battery. And it's large enough so that anything that the load is that can't use is still remains in storage, and you don't lose that power. And so from that point on, everything, every step in there, the key point is that the transformer's not getting hot, the capacitors are not getting hot, the rectifier's not getting hot, and your load, unless it's like a light bulb or something that is set up for resistance, is not getting hot. So, LED systems, so on down the line, the more efficient devices you can use that power on all the way down there, you can start to see that your efficiency level is raising up, and it didn't require near the amount of input that it would have otherwise from the standard way that we're using electricity. The standard way that we're using electricity is really literally destructive. It causes things to get hot. It causes computers to have fans running, which makes it even more inefficient. And so, because that thing, you're trying to push a lot of power to that thing, and it's, getting hot, you have to have, cooling systems on there, heat sinks, something to take away that heat from that material, because once anything reaches its thermal breakdown, it will fail. It'll melt. The insulation on the windings, the epoxy resin that they actually coat the windings with and whatever, it has a thermal breakdown point. Once it reaches that, it fails. And then once it does, then that means you have a dead short. Well, instead of 1,000 turns of wire on your primary or your secondary, you're down to 1 or whatever, because it's all shorted out across there. And, that's the failure. But the key about what I've been explaining is the signal generator doesn't have to work hard, so it's not getting hot. The microwave oven transformer, it's not working hard, so it doesn't get hot. The capacitors aren't getting hot, the rectifiers aren't getting hot, everything down the line using the power in this manner is making it so that you're not reaching the thermal breakdown point of any of the components that it takes to move that energy from point A to point B. So, now you have a basic understanding. When I put it into practice and I show you in my new lab, which I'm really excited about when I get this thing done, I'm having a few delays due to financial issues, but I'm getting there slowly but surely, but once I get this new lab, it's not only going to look really nice, it's going to be well organized so that when I do these videos, won't be like all the old videos in the past where I'm trying to show you a concept of something and my lab's all cluttered up. I'm not going to have that. It's going to be so that you get a good general view and knowledge of exactly what it is that I've been saying. You know exactly how it works. You know how to replicate it. And so from that point on, what you do with that information is all up to you. But I told the power company I was gonna study every single thing that there was to know about alternative energy. And when I got that accomplished, I'm going to share it with every single one of their customers for free. And I meant what I said. And that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm getting ready to open the floodgates of information and start putting all this stuff into perspective. I've been sitting there trying to gather the masses and show them, get them ready. Get them ready to show them what it is that I'm getting ready to show them. How to take your efficiency level so ridiculously high, even if you can't classify it as free energy because you're still paying the man to some extent, you're going to be a lot better off because they're not going to be able to charge you near what they do now. And, with these concepts in play, you won't be out there replacing all your appliances so frequently because they'll never reach their thermal breakdown. If you do maintenance on an electric fan, you keep that thing clean, mostly because it needs to have some airflow through it to keep it cooled down. The transformer, if it's all clogged up with dirt inside there, or the electric motor, if it's clogged up with dirt, can't get enough airflow to cool that core down, that heat will build up and it'll transfer to the electrical windings, and eventually the electrical windings will lose its insulation and the electricity will basically jump the gap, creating a dead short. And so your fan will be no good. And if you run it until the fan completely seizes up with the bearing failure or something like that, that power's still coming in. It's still generating more heat, and eventually the sucker will catch on fire. So if your breaker don't shut off in time, you burn your dang house down. That's why your breaker's set up the way to do what it does. So, with that said, now that you understand that, with doing some maintenance or whatever, keeping that thing nice and clean, and keeping the bearings well lubricated and all that, you'll never replace another electrical fan in your life. That thing will last forever, because as long as it can never reach its thermal breakdown, as long as it doesn't, air around it don't deteriorate it, you keep it maintained and everything, you'll never replace another electrical fan ever again for the rest of your life. So that's the key. There are fans that have been around for 100 years or more that still, to this very day, function as well as they did back in the day. Of course, now I wouldn't recommend having one of those fans because they didn't have safety in mind back then. All they wanted to do is keep cool. So a lot of those were old brass blades that had an open screen in there, and you got your finger in there, you're liable to lose your finger. At bare minimum, it's going to hurt like you know what. But modern day, they got a little wiser and put a little bit of a screen on there. A little kid could still get his finger in the fan, but we try to keep them away from that kind of stuff. But either way, even the modern day fans, as long as you maintain them, a lot of times there's a little a capacitor in some of these modern day fans that thing is the only portion of it that fails. So if that capacitor goes bad for some reason, maybe it had a sudden surge and it broke down the insulation between the plates inside there, then you replace that capacitor, that fan will fire right back up because there's nothing wrong with the motor. It was just the capacitor all along. So a little bit of understanding like that will save you a lot of money. And even when it comes to devices in your car, like electric motors in your car, if you have a basic understanding of how those things function, you can take one of those window motors You can take that thing apart, clean it up, re-grease it, put it back together, and you don't have to buy a new one unless it jammed to the extent where it actually burned up the wiring inside there. But the wiring inside there is like really thick, and it hardly ever fails. Usually what happens is on those electric motors for your window regulator is that there's carbon brushes inside there and grease inside there, and now over the years of going up and down, it grinds off some of that carbon and mixes with the grease and gets in between those two brushes and won't allow a good current to go through there to run it. And so with that said, open it up, clean it up, put it back together. It works just like brand new. It'll save you some doggone money. Anyway, those are the kind of things, little tips and tricks that I learned along the way while studying about alternative energy and such. So you'd be surprised. Once again, I encourage you to download all these videos that I played today on today's show. And, save them for future reference and download this podcast, because it's all going to turn the light bulb on, and it's going to keep the light bulb on if you understand what I'm saying. So with that, I'm going to start with this one right here, because there are some interesting things going on in this here. The Secrets of Electricity,
Everyone has to obey the laws of physics, even if you're the king. Night into day, create life, or cause death. This is all part of the mystery and magic of electricity. We knew what it was, long before we harnessed it, electricity was flowing through our bodies, descended from the heavens.
So there's constantly current flowing into the earth from thunderstorms and flowing out where there's not thunderstorms. And in that process, an electric field is generated in the atmosphere. We walk around, the voltage between your head and your toes when you walk around is 200 or 300 volts, and nobody notices that because you grew up in it.
But when there is enough of a voltage difference between the clouds and the earth, it's hard not to notice. One of those who was fascinated by the phenomenon was Benjamin Franklin.
Ben Franklin was a really smart guy. He was one of the original experimenters with electricity, period. He, in fact, invented the designation of positive and negative charge.
Today, high technology has replaced the kite. In North Central Florida, scientists summon lightning and bring it to the earth with a rocket and a wire.
We can make the cloud produce lightning and direct it where we want to direct it to do tests, and that really hasn't been possible before.
They direct the lightning to strike simulated houses and power lines to understand what happens when it hits. The rocket launch provides a more controlled experiment than anything Ben Franklin could have imagined.
Well, we do similar things. He didn't think his kite was going to get struck, and he thought that if it was going to get struck, that he wouldn't get hurt. So he was wrong there. If the kite had been struck, he probably would have been killed, as have many people flying kites.
They load a rocket and launch it into the belly of a thundercloud. From the rocket's tail, a spool of copper wire unwinds, creating a path for the lightning to follow.
There's a level of excitement and tension before you push the button, and then there's a level of holding your breath for 2 seconds when the rocket goes up that's unlike anything else. And success feels real good, because we only make it happen 20, 25 times a summer, so every one is a big deal.
It's like a rocket-powered lightning rod. Once the wire is shot up into the air, the lightning hits it. In an instant, the electric current of the bolt moves down the wire, disintegrating it into a green vapor.
What flows down the lightning at 50,000 amps is the same thing that flows in your wall at 10 amps.
The temperature of a lightning bolt is more than 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit, 6 times hotter than the surface of the sun. All that heat and light is generated by uncounted numbers of electrons being forced to move. An atom's nucleus has a positive charge. Electrons orbiting the nucleus have a negative charge. When electric current flows, electrons are torn from atoms and move freely.
Electricity is the flow of electrical charge, and most of the charge flows as electrons moving.
Whenever there's an oversupply of electrons, an object develops an overall negative charge. Nature balances things out with equal positive charges somewhere else. The potential difference between the charges is measured in volts. Electric current, anything from static electricity to lightning volts, is electrons moving from negative to positive.
It seems like it's easier to make sparks and lightning than not to make them. Anytime you have two dissimilar materials rubbing together, you get sparks.
The path that leaping electrons follows depends on the material they flow through.
The human body certainly will conduct current, but not a lot. Not like a piece of copper.
Copper has a lot of loosely held electrons, so it's a good conductor. The electrons of clay and rubber are too tightly bound to their atoms to conduct electricity. They're said to be insulators. How electrons begin to move in the first place is a result of a force of nature called electromagnetism. Our whole technological civilization exists because electricity can make magnetism, and magnetism can make electricity.
It goes back to the fact that we have two kinds of forces that are present that we call electricity or electromagnetism. And those two forces are the electric force and the magnetic force. The fundamental charges are a positive charge and a negative charge.
To see these forces at work, head north and look up into the night sky. Basically, the northern lights are the result of high-energy electrical currents from the sun that are caught and guided by the Earth's magnetic field. There's electricity out there.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And we have liftoff of the Space Shuttle Columbia, continuing space research through Tether satellite technology.
On February 25th, 1996, NASA and Italian researchers made a bold attempt to harness the power in the atmosphere. They generated electricity with a satellite on a wire.
Good work. Let's make sure we stay that way. I understand.
The mission was part of a new experiment of tethering satellites in space.
Attitude verification. Great hash 14. Go ahead.
The experiment was based on the simple principle that when you move a conductor through a magnetic field, electrons start to flow. This generates an electrical current that can flow through a circuit. The satellite was thrust into space using small gas jets, and the 13-mile-long cable began to unreel.
If you put a wire inside of that tether, you now have a moving wire that moves across a magnetic field. That magnetic field, in this case, is the Earth's magnetic field, and the motion is the motion of the space shuttle moving at very fast, high velocities, orbital speeds.
Flying down here, Jeff.
The moving wire in the Earth's magnetic field generated 3,500 volts, enough energy to power a space station.
Okay, we see the tension go way down, but the tether's still going out fine. Very slight lateral oscillation.
The tether was clearly visible from the ground. It was one of the biggest man-made objects ever sent into space. For 5 hours, the tether swept through our planet's magnetic field, generating more and more electricity.
At the moon, the tether has broken. It is going away from us. Get it on the TV, Claude. The tether has broken.
Copy.
Photograph is floating away from us.
The wire was generating so much electricity that a spark jumped from the wire to the satellite deployment system and burned through the tether. NASA will try the experiment again because it could lead to a new, more reliable power system for space stations and help avoid situations like the Mir mishap.
We're moving moving to actually is if we drive current in the opposite direction in the tether and if we can force the current to go the other way, it becomes a propulsive device. So a propellantless spacecraft, the next generation of space travelers may be using electric propulsion devices as opposed to chemical propulsion devices. A little Star Trek, if you will.
Perhaps we notice electricity most when we don't have any. On July 13, 1977, New York City experienced a blackout. For 25 hours, New Yorkers were without lights or elevators or alarms. Lightning had knocked out power lines north of the city, and the utility company's backup equipment malfunctioned.
It takes a lot to keep the electricity working, not just in machinery, but in manpower. And it costs a lot of money to maintain these systems. Utilities have to maintain their lines.
In the United States, 98% of homes and businesses receive power from a vast electrical system that is woven together with a web of power lines. A grid. These power lines are naked live wires, carrying 500,000 volts. It's up to the linemen to inspect and repair every part of the grid, usually without shutting down the power.
Yeah, Bill, I was going to start making a gradual left turn and start heading over towards the line.
One of the most daring techniques is used on very high voltage tension lines.
It's pretty dangerous, I feel, because you're mixing aviation with electricity. One, you're depending on the helicopter, everything mechanical to go right. If it goes wrong, you're going to drop out of the sky like a rock. If the lineman makes a mistake, you're going to vaporize.
These linemen and pilots work for Ag Rotors Incorporated. One of the few companies that attempts these high wire acts, Ag Rotors has the best safety record in the business.
There's linemen all over the United States that are risking their lives every day to keep the power flowing.
The dangerous marriage between helicopters and power lines is made to save money and time. Repairs that take a conventional ground crew days, Ag Rotors completes in hours.
And, Bill, we're just looking for the right structure number and and then we're going to have to probably turn back a spin or two once we over.
We could actually get too close to a power line and a tree, and the electricity would arc amongst all of us, and you know, we could actually short out the power line and, you know, destroy ourselves.
If you were able to take a voltmeter, which measures voltage, and measure the voltage on that helicopter, it would be energized at 500,000 volts in anything on that helicopter.
The metal wand gives the electricity a controlled pathway from the wire to the helicopter. Once the pathway is established, the lineman replaces the electrical connection held by the wand. Metal clamp the allow the line free his hands so that it can work.
And I knocked unbeknown and went my mouth.
Sorry, something in the video has gone bad.
Feelings out of my rise my up form.
Stop that for a second to see if that's going to do it. It's the video itself.
Long time.
The generators produce 16,500 volts of electricity. Before it leaves the power plant, the electricity's voltage is increased or boosted to 230,000 volts for long distance travel. At the other end of the line, the process is reversed, and the high voltage is stepped down to 110 volts and delivered into millions of homes. In the shanty towns of Rio de Janeiro, Brazilians who are unable to pay for electrical power learn how to tap into the grid for free.
Bom, eu levo o fio da ligação da minha casa.
I take wire from my house up to a clock or a light post. And from there, I bring in the electricity.
Electricity is siphoned from main lines and tangles of makeshift wiring. Live wires and unsafe connections are hazards that the local people live with. Or in some tragic cases, die by.
Horrível porque ele não sobreviveu. Ele foi fazer uma ligação.
It was horrible because the electrician pirate didn't survive. He was making a connection for a lady whose house had had a blackout. He had been in the water earlier, so he was wet. He climbed on a zinc rooftop and started touching the wire. He got a strong shock and was thrown from the spot and died.
Las Vegas.
Well, people are like insects. They just love light, and they're drawn to it, and they want to see what it's all about. And so the casino operators and everybody here put a lot of light out, and it just draws people in. It just says, we're having a party here. Come on in.
In Vegas, the theory is, if you build it, they will come. And if you build it and cover it with lights, they will come and spend money.
Without electricity, this town would just be another sleepy place in the desert.
From space, it's the brightest man-made spot on the planet. Millions of bulbs that all, at one time or another, burn out and need to be changed. Every night, crews from the Young Electric Sign Company go to work repairing and replacing bulbs. One of their biggest jobs is the Fremont Street Experience. On a grid above pedestrians shine 2 million bulbs and a $70 million light show. The town never shuts down, but things are a little slower after midnight. That's when the crews test the system and make repairs. It's Homer King's job to change the bulbs.
That way the computer will tell it how bright to go. These bulbs have a life expectancy of 25,000 hours. I'm on a roll tonight here.
A light bulb lights because its filament offers some resistance to the flow of electrons.
Okay, that looks better.
As the electrons try to crowd through a hair-thin tungsten wire, the energy spent overcoming resistance turns into heat.
A material that's resistive is one that requires some kind of work to push the charge across. That means you're giving up energy that turns into heat and will heat that element up.
And here, heat means light. The filament reaches a temperature of about 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit. On Fremont Street, the bulbs burn bright. 7 shows a day, 7 days a week. And nothing stops the display, except for thunderstorms.
We run this color for about 10 to 15 minutes. People ask us all the time, does this keep rain out? Well, no, it doesn't keep rain out. Water doesn't really hurt it. What hurts is this.
I want to pause that and go back to that light bulb for a second. She said that filament reaches 4,500 degrees. Imagine a system set up to where, built into that light bulb, you actually had a coil tubing system set up that wouldn't interfere with how that light bulb actually works, but because it's in a vacuum, that it wouldn't melt like that tungsten element doesn't melt because it's got that hot. But at that same time, you could extract that heat from that element and use that heat to, heat up your water heater or something like that. So it's just an idea that I run across the table one time. I was just thinking about while she was talking about the temperature of that bulb in a tungsten element. Let's keep going.
Lightning. We got 30 computers on the other side of this frame. So when the light moves there, we shut it down.
The Fremont street lights are controlled by 121 computers. It's the largest outdoor sign in the world, towering 90 feet high and spanning almost 5 football fields.
Hard Rocks, this is one of my favorite properties here.
Not all the lights in Las Vegas rely on bulbs. Neon and fluorescent lights use electricity to excite atoms that do the glowing, instead of heating up a thin wire. The signs may change, but using light to attract crowds has been around since electricity was harnessed. Coney Island was one of the very first places to use electricity. Thomas Edison lit it up with a million of his new incandescent bulbs. They called it an electric Eden.
Being, I guess, almost like a new world. It was like the playground of the world, and being all lit up.
At the turn of the century, Coney was the largest amusement park in the world. Charles Dickens, Mark Twain, Sigmund Freud, Herman Melville, and Walt Whitman were among the thousands who flocked to see the magical electric light at work.
Coney Island wouldn't be Coney Island without electricity. If you remember correctly, electricity made its debut in Coney Island.
Coney is lights. Coney is movement. Coney is electric.
Oh, about that, Tesla also had, fluorescent bulbs back in the day that he invented. So, he could have done it a lot more efficiently using AC current. So, just a side note there.
The electric Astroland Cyclone is ranked one of the top 5 roller coasters in the country, and it is one of the oldest. By the time it reaches the bottom, it's traveling 55 miles an hour. And the passengers feel the force of 4 Gs. For the last 70 years, this electric motor has made it all possible, pulling the 7-ton car to the top of the hill. An electric motor is a generator in reverse, turning electricity into motion instead of the other way around. The motor is connected to a belt that turns a 15-foot wheel that pulls the chain. It's a powerful system. When the roller coaster clanks up the hill, the motor is drawing 600 amps, enough electricity to power 3 modern homes. Coney Island was one of the first places that exploited electricity for profit and pleasure.
Good news. It's the only use. I mean, listen, electricity, it attracts us all. If we didn't have electricity, where would we be?
As soon as scientists were able to capture electrical energy, they began to experiment with it. In 1780, an Italian anatomist, Luigi Galvani, made groundbreaking discoveries.
Galvani made lightning measurements. Galvani took frogs' legs and showed that when it lightninged, that they twitched. So he showed that the lightning radiates an electric field which produces a voltage on the frog legs.
Pull the switch. I thought I saw a pulsation of a heart. Dr. Bradshaw, you're beginning to breathe. You brought this man back to life.
No. The heart muscle simply responded to a terrific electrical shock, that's all.
What was once thought to be science fiction turned out to be fact. A heart beats because every second, electrical impulses spread through the heart muscle, triggering and coordinating a movement. These signals send echoes through the body tissue to the skin, where they can be detected by metal sensors and displayed as an electrocardiogram, an electrical readout that allows doctors to constantly monitor the heartbeat.
Electricity, electrical impulses are all over the body.
The electricity in our bodies is created by chemical reactions between cells.
What triggers the heart to squeeze are these signals, these small electrical currents, which travel from the outside to the inside of the cell every time your heart beats.
Dr. Hugh Calkins is an electrophysiologist at Johns Hopkins University. He uses electricity to treat and cure electrical malfunctions of the heart. Today, he is implanting a device in a patient who suffers from a condition that causes the heart to beat too fast.
It takes a certain amount of the heart time for the heart to squeeze blood out of the heart and also for blood to get back in very, very fast. Instead of squeezing in a rhythmic fashion, it will literally be quivering and no blood will flow in the body. And within seconds, you'll pass out, and in minutes after that, you'll be dead.
In order to restore the heartbeat, the victim needs an electrical shock.
When you just put these on the body, you get what's called a quick look, that this acts as an antenna. You can see what the heart rhythm is, and if it's not what you want it to be, if it's ventricular fibrillation, then you can go ahead and discharge it. The way that's done is by pushing both of these buttons simultaneously will cause these to fire, and that will give a 360-joule shock across the body. And to the degree that the heart's in between, the heart will be depolarized and normal rhythm will be restored.
In the electrophysiology lab, the technology of portable defibrillators is now being implanted in the body. Calkins threads a small wire lead down into the heart.
That's up in the pulmonary artery.
The wire lead acts like permanent paddles on the heart. If the implantable defibrillator detects a problem, it will automatically give an electrical shock to the heart within 10 or 15 seconds.
When I put one of these in, you really have this comforting sensation that this patient, it's like as if they're in the intensive care unit forever, that if ever they develop a rhythm abnormality, too slow or too fast, it will take care of it. And it's really this tremendous insurance policy.
The most critical part of the procedure is the testing of the device.
Here we go.
The patient is given a shock that puts his heart into overdrive. The heart starts fluttering rather than beating steadily. Ventricular fibrillation, they call it. Sudden cardiac death. It's the only way to test the device.
When we were putting in the defibrillator is when we induced this ventricular fibrillation, this very fast heart rhythm. You saw a lot of very rapid squiggles on the screen, and that was the heart beating very, very chaotically with multiple short circuits swirling around the heart, resulting in the heart beating 400 or 500 beats a minute.
10 joules is about 500 volts. Yeah, this shows the whole readout and how we induce it with a shock. This is and it takes, you can see, about 8 seconds for the device to charge up and get them out of the rhythm.
The trick is to customize the implantable defibrillator so it delivers the lowest level of energy that can still get the heart beating back to its normal rhythm.
So
there's more and more enthusiasm about the benefits of electricity. I know for many, many years there was a lot of debate over was it better to treat patients with sudden cardiac death with medications or with defibrillators. And now the studies are available showing that defibrillators are better than medications, at least the medications we have now. So there's a case where electricity won, where electricity was better.
This is a Utah arm, one of the newest links between human and machine. The device uses the body's own electrical impulses to operate and control an electrical arm. John Migueles works with amputees, teaching them how to use and operate the myoelectric arm.
Right now there's a race between limb transplant and electronics. We start off with a silicone skin, and inside it there are electrical motors that control the opening and closing of the fingers. Next, very often we have a electrical motor here that operates wrist rotation, supination or pronation. Then we also have an electrical motor over here that controls this transmission that you can see that controls flexion and extension of the elbow. The microcomputer is mounted right here, and that processes all that information. One of the neat things about the hand is it offers a lot of pinch force, over 22 pounds of pinch. So we need to be very careful when we're grasping things.
Bob Goodman controls his bionic arm by contracting his biceps and triceps muscles.
I like to grab my brother's hand and squeeze and kind of watch his eyes a little bit. Maybe that's a little bit of bionic feeling.
Ironically, it was electricity that destroyed Bob Goodman's arm in the first place. He was up on a roof removing a television antenna when something went wrong.
This antenna became top-heavy and came in contact with high-voltage lines in back of us, some 12,500 volts. It was an aluminum ladder that I was on, and so it became very hot and burnt my leg. Luckily, I was knocked loose of the ladder and hit the ground, because some of the doctors think, well, with that amount of volts, your heart probably did stop. When I hit the ground, it kind of jump-started my heart again. So I felt very fortunate when I learned this, that I got a second chance at life, even though I was missing my right arm.
When the brain sends an electrical signal to flex the arm muscle, the signal, or impulse, is intercepted at the muscle site by electrodes, or skin sensors. This electric impulse is then amplified and used by a microcomputer to control the electrical motors in the arm.
The patient has to be able to produce two independent signals, or muscle contractions. Typically with Bob in this situation, we're using biceps and tricep muscles, but he has to be able to fire those independently. If he were to fire them together, it would tell the hand to open and close at the same time, which would just create a little jitter in the hand.
In a myoelectric arm, when you lock the elbow here to make the hand work,
To
unlock this elbow, it takes the flex of both muscle sites at the same time and then an instant relaxation. So for me to get that elbow to unlock, it took quite a few months, actually. I would always flex one site before the other. So it was releasing the elbow is what took me the most time to get down.
So how are things going? You having any particular problems?
Not really. I've put a new harness on and snugged up the fit in my socket, so it seems to be responding really well.
Great. How's that battery doing?
Well, I'll turn this arm off here, and the batteries are holding up real well. This new battery pack is lasting 4 to 5 days for me.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and stop that one there. Everything from how electricity works all the way up to essentially a bionic arm. Electricity is everywhere. Your body uses electricity. You know, electricity can be dangerous. It can be beneficial, so on down the line. There's places in this world where you heard in this same podcast where people have to try to pirate electricity in order to keep power on and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes, tragically enough, it ends in loss of life because of lack of safety precautions and such like that. But nonetheless, we've become reliant on electricity. We need electricity for a lot of different things, whether it be from health all the way to, you know, just luxury items such as TVs, video games, or whatever, you know. And so my hopes is to be able to try to educate the people of the world in a different way to use electricity so much more efficiently and in a safer manner. That it would actually allow you to keep your appliances a whole lot longer than, you know, you otherwise would. You know, something as simple as the electric fan that I talked about. You know, they only fail when, you know, one of two things happens. Either the bearings, you know, fail because lack of lubrication, or, you know, the somehow or another, the electric windings in there reach their thermal breakdown point, and then they fail that way. But just simply by a little bit of maintenance and keeping that thing clean, making sure that there's no dust plugging up that motor, you can keep any friction and all that down to a bare minimum to keep that thing down below its thermal breakdown point, and so nothing will fail. The other option would be that the modern day fans, some of which have capacitors in their AC capacitors that, you know, if they have a sudden surge, that can actually destroy the capacitor and the capacitor fails. So it's as simple as just replacing a capacitor and you got an electric fan again. So, you know, all these little simple concepts, you know, are really important information. And so I hope that today's show give you a general understanding of how the power comes to you, what can be done with the power, you know, all the way down to this last deal where, you know, they're using electricity to make a bionic arm, you know, or to make a pacemaker to reset somebody's rhythm of their heart and that kind of stuff. It's a magical force that, you know, I just think is amazing. And if you understand that, if you understand a bit about nature and mechanics and the basic science and physics and, you know, how things work, you pay attention in the school of nature, and you pay attention, you know, in the school of science and mechanics and all that kind of stuff, general observations, and you'd be surprised at what you really know that you didn't think you knew. So there's a lot more energy out there than you could possibly imagine. Those lightning bolts could probably run this entire, you know, earth that we're on. It could, you know, it's amazing. We could actually, you know, harness the forces of nature. And so we're mimicking on a small scale the forces of nature and doing what nature does. And we're using, utilizing and capturing and storing that energy. And, you know, the way that we use our power, like I said, we're using it in a destructive manner, so it causes our equipment to fail. You know, they get hot, your computers get hot, they get plugged up with dust. Every once in a while, if you take your computer apart and clean it out, you know, real good, blow it off with some dirt, get all the dust out of the heat sinks and off the fans and all that, you'll get your computer to last a whole lot longer that way. But in the future, if we engineer these equipments to be more efficient and use power a lot better, then we won't have near the problems. I could even see a day when your computer would not even need a fan running. The fan would only be there as a backup in case, you know, your maintenance skills weren't up to par and you didn't clean it out. And so when it starts to get to that temperature where it needs to cool down, then the fan would kick on. You know, just like your car. Your car has a radiator fan. Modern day cars have an electrical fan with a thermal switch that when your radiator gets up to a certain temperature, it automatically open the switch and turn that fan on, cool your motor down. When the motor gets to the right temperature again, it'll shut her back down again. So, you know, it's all simple. It's not rocket science, folks, and we have all the pieces of the puzzle necessary to quite literally resolve all the problems that we have, that we're facing here today. And as far as, you know, constantly paying the man, sure, you know, for them to generate electricity, you know, it costs money. They got to pay employees, they got to pay maintenance and all that kind of stuff, and they move that over to you. But at some point, they end up making more money or gathering more money from the government or whatever, and so they got it made. But you, on the other hand, when you see your bills, you know, Barack Obama said, under my plan, your electric bill will necessarily skyrocket. So he's telling you, under his plan, you're going to have to pay more money. Electricity's free. Nature provides it. With all the things that nature does, energy is free. And so, with that said, if you understand the concept of what I showed you today, and you stay tuned for the, practical demonstrations where I put this application down right in front of you, you know, so that you can see it with your own two eyes, what it is that I've been talking about, and it'll make so much sense to you. So once again, I encourage you to download all these podcasts that you are interested in. Download today's podcast at the very least, and all these videos, so that you can go back later and look them up as a reference. There's photos available that are posted in the chat room. There's photos and links in the on the website at ShazizRadio.com. Stephen Gibbons put together a resource page of all different types of alternative energy research and researchers. Just an amazing job he did on that. I can't thank him enough for it. But, you know, at least do something good for him and go over and visit that page, because, you know, he really put a lot of time and effort into that. And if we all work together, if we get all these networks together and keep on doing what it is we're doing, we can make our world a better place, one positive pebble at a time. I still believe in the dream, folks. And I got some amazing things that I want to share with the world, you know, and I'm trying to do it in the most creative and efficient way possible so that everyone can understand. I'm not trying to drop high-tech terminology onto you to try to, you know, baffle your brain or anything like that. I want you to be able to understand it as simple as you do when you put your finger over a garden hose and cause the water to squirt clear across the yard, you know, or air pressure or whatever. You know, I want you to understand it that simply, that if you understand how water works, pressure and volume, if you understand air pressure, same exact concept is with electricity. And when you understand all that, and then you want to generate power, you know, whether it be with any of these forces, you know how to do it. And so all these things, these transformers and stuff out there, you could pulse one of those transformers with a circuit board and a doggone 12-volt car battery, you know. The amount of power that you get out the other side, you know, may not necessarily be the exact amount of power that, you know, the power company's trying to push down through there. But I'm saying that under the right circumstances, you don't need that amount of power to run the things that you run in your house. A little bit of, you know, update in some engineering and maybe even some minor modifications, you can get those appliances to run on so much less than what they do now. And remain cool because you're not trying to shove too much power to them. So it's not about we don't have enough power. It's that we're using it improperly. We're not using it efficiently. And the fact that nature has been able to amaze us with static discharges, electric lightning, and all that kind of stuff. You heard in the one podcast, the guy said you're walking in about 200 from your feet all the way up to your head is about 200 volts. If you know how to use that power, you know, hey, it's there. That's what I've been trying to say. And you know, there's groups out there like the Atmospheric Group that did research and run, you know, wires up a pole a couple hundred feet in the air, about four poles running around, and they're pulling power straight out of the air down, to big old capacitor storage banks that they're able to use. All that can be added to. So, you know, like I said, an idea is just an idea until you take it and run with it. So if you get any ideas here, I want you to take them and run with them. And as far as transformers, you see how it's built. You understand how it works. We can make custom transformers. We can make a custom transformer that you could put in your yard for backup emergencies, that if the main transformer went down, you could isolate the main power input and switch it over, automatic or even manually, so that there's no backfeed possibility to the deal. Basically like a grid tie inverter or something like that, where, you know, when your power goes down, you have a battery backup system, and it automatically detects when the power line comes back on, and so you can, have power no matter what happens. So all these are concepts that are fully, available for us. If we build custom transformers that are designed specifically to run your house, just like that pole transformer does, and we use alternative methods in order to energize these transformers, then the job's already done. And as far as modern day, future, designs, how we engineer generators and stuff, if we take all these concepts and apply them, we'll have more efficient generators, and we'll have more efficient engines, even to the extent of the way that we run internal combustion engines. We can improve upon that. We can get things, because just about everything out there, well, I'll pretty much say almost everything, if not everything out there, is fuel under the right circumstances. And if you understand how that's possible, which I tried to explain to in one of the shows that I did here recently, I think maybe last week, but that podcast is available too. And so, you know, if you hear any of these shows and you like them, please share the links. Get people in these chat rooms and get them talking, so we can show them and give them this information that they can use. There's no reason to be, worrying about a power grid outage. There's enough equipment around, and we can engineer our own style transformers, custom designed to use different frequency ranges, and be able to be more beneficial, more efficient, and be there for just such an emergency that the main system fails. So we don't have to worry about it. If we utilize the gifts and the knowledge and the technology we have right now, we got it made, folks. And I'm just trying to bring everybody together to tell them, we got it made. I'm willing to help anybody with projects and try to do what I can. And if they got some knowledge that I don't, we share knowledge. That's what we do here, people, for People Radio Network and Shaziz Radio. Folks, you've been listening to Mad Science. Stay tuned for the music with Kara Hour. Peace and love, everybody. Take care. Share this podcast and download those videos. Take care, everybody.
It stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one hand.
Ooh, one hand. Yeah, you're right. It's just one hand.
Yeah, boss, they're puny.
Hmm, puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this? You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.